There's a condition that crops up pretty regularly in the human experience. And the word that will be most familiar to you is clueless, where you really don't know the answer, and where you really don't know where to look for the answer. And every effort to try to find it comes up stymied. The normal human condition is to reach into the world of clueless people, in a world of impermanence, in a world of total and endless changeability, and try to find solution to the thing you're trying to understand. And in that clueless realm, millions of other clueless people chime in to give you clues, which do not clarify the cluelessness. The remedy on some level for that is the inward journey into a place of clarification, some sense of deeper wisdom, knowing, familiarity with a little bit of future and past that gives you a bit of a bigger vista on which to sort of look at your cluelessness. And if you go really deep inside, answers arise, pointers, things that kind of subvert the cluelessness and begin to tell you what to do, how to respond, how to act, which way to head. And sometimes you'll like the answers, and sometimes you won't like the answers. And sometimes you will obey what you hear, and sometimes you will disobey. There are even times where you go inside and nothing arrives. Or even more complicated, you try to get in and the doors are completely locked and barred. You cannot find your way into what may have been a familiar space. Like, whoa, you always let me in before. Why aren't you letting me in right now? And then you're really clueless, because now how do I get into the place that always gave me solace and comfort and clarity and, you know, directionality and guidance? What do you do when that's not there? And why would that door be closed at all once you've learned to open it? Well, I can reference a number of things. In the early days of my writing career, every so often I would be flooded with what I would call inspiration, direction, and purpose. And I would start to write, particularly this early script called Jacob's Ladder. I started to write and I found I was taking dictation. I had almost nothing to do with it. I was just and writing this thing so fast. And Blanche, I remember walking into my office, I've talked about this, and I had my little son Ari on my lap, and I used to rock him like this, and I'm typing like this. And she looks over my shoulder and starts reading this thing on the typewriter. And it was scary. And she said, "What are you writing?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know. But I'm writing, and I'm writing so hard." And this thing wrote itself all the way to the end. And I was like, wow. And it really was a door opener in my life. It was presented to a lot of people who looked at it as something worthy. And I was given the credit. It's like the secretary taking credit for the boss's decisions. But I was very happy to take it. And I felt some ownership because it passed through the system. And it was very powerful, and it was I had to make fixes on it, which were somehow not as dictated, but I did work on it. And then as I started to parlay that experience into more scripts, I found so many different things would happen when I would start to write. Sometimes this flood of inspiration would come in, the opening scene would just be thrown at me, and I go, oh yeah. And then doors closed, shop down, nothing available. And I was like, okay. And the instruction that I kind of got is, you're on your own, figure it out. And it was very scary. I knew that at that point I had upped the ante, meaning I had to pay to keep my family alive. I had to support myself. I had to demonstrate something that proved my worth to people who were willing to, you know, pay for my effort. There's a lot more on the table, a lot more at stake. And I just didn't know what to do, but move one step at a time. Just keep writing scenes, work it out, figure it out. Every so often, a little glimmer of something would come through that would kind of move me this way or that way. And then when I would get toward the end, something would happen often. The lights would shine on and it would say, okay, change this, do that, do this, do that. Perfect. And it would allow for something to complete itself, but it absolutely required my participation. I was not in a state of constant inspiration, support, bliss, or whatever you want to call it. I was being taught that there was a two-way street here. There was something being given by whatever you want to call it, the muses, and then there was my learning to have the muscle to translate what was given into something that had substance and quality and value. And I really did learn that there was a connection. And that connection played out according to its terms, not my terms, its terms. And sometimes I really felt what it was trying to guide me into, sometimes I didn't. This cluelessness would come up repeatedly, but I still had to act. I could no longer sit back and just wait for this flow of something from on high. It knew that, and I knew that, and I took up the responsibility of building a career based on knowing there was something watching over me. It had my back on some level, but its job was to make me a capable, functioning writer, a communicator. It allowed me to find a voice, and every so often it would come in and augment that voice. Sometimes it would completely take over the voice and speak. And I learned over time to be grateful for every indication of its presence, every moment of awareness where I knew, yes, this is the way to go. This is the answer. It was often increasingly subtle, but I paid attention because, again, I had house payments, I had college tuition, I had all of these things that had to be done, and the only way they were going to happen is if this flow continued. So it wasn't just an abstraction, it was a real thing. And what I wouldn't understand usually is why that cluelessness was so unpleasant, unexpected. I used to get to these moments in life where I felt I had been supported long enough, loved long enough, given, helped along the way long enough that it would never occur again. And then it would. I could not find a way out of being, if you will, manipulated by something in the universe that had its own purpose, that was apparently, in my sense, using me to function in the world as a creative person, as a husband, as a father, as a teacher, and everything else. There was a lot of demand being made, and it was supported by something great that every so often would evaporate. there are old teachings about people sitting outside the temple door for years on end, waiting for entry. And that somehow that sitting ennobles us. It demonstrates to the priests or whoever are waiting for us inside our intention. There are lots of allegories about that temple door. Some that say, you know, you could have knocked. Tried the handle. Some that say they need to see your intention. They need to know that you're going to sit there in the snowstorm, you're going to sit there in the rainstorm, and you are serious about this. But it's pretty clear, if you come to the temple doors and you sit down on the steps in front of it, and you have a cup of coffee and you look at your watch and you talk to your, you know, somebody on the phone, and you get up and walk away, those doors are meaningless. Nobody's inviting you in. Nobody's waiting for you inside because you're not waiting for them. You're not making the effort. There's something we all have to do in the world that gives us entree to something profoundly meaningful, which is the muse, the guiding force, the awareness that allows us to live life with some modicum of grace. I've had an episode the last few weeks. The last whatever has been tricky. I don't know, stuff's going on. The door opens for me pretty regularly. I have access to myself. I get invited in, I get restored, I get connected to my higher self. I get acknowledged, I get wisdom often for myself and for others. I feel so blessed in this ability to love this thing that I am and that we all are, and that it loves me back. And it, when I don't know that it's loving me, little things happen. I think I talked about this last week, I don't remember, but I had a difficult day. And forgive me, for those of you who think teachers don't have difficult days, let me tell you that human beings have difficult days. And we have to find ways to deal with those stresses and dramas that go on in our lives, especially if you're, you know, a father and a grandfather and a teacher and all these other things, and things come at you, and they do. And I went for a long walk, which is my new thing. I mean, I could sit and meditate, but somehow walking does wonders for me. And I was walking down the street, this is about 3 weeks ago, and I touched a tree. And I felt the tree touch me back. I connected to myself. That tree was myself. I could not believe how comforting it was for that tree and I to make connection. I'm not talking tree hugging. I'm talking touch, touch. That tree affirmed something. It just said, it's okay. And I touched another tree and it had a different texture and a different quality, and it said the same thing. And then one more tree, and it was softer and gentler, and I just felt the universe spoke to me. It spoke to me. The tree didn't lean over to touch me, just so you know that. I reached out and I touched the tree and it touched me back. And I felt, okay, okay. Whatever it was that was causing struggle and conflict inside melted away. And by the time I returned home, I was in a beautifully simple place. I had walked it off, walked it out, whatever you want to call it. You can meditate it off, meditate it out, whatever your technique is. Walking is really, for me, turning into something quite wonderful. This last week was really hard. And I'm always hesitant to talk about the hardness because I think so many people want the people who sit in front of them and teach to be past all that, to be so elevated that they don't touch the human dimension. That is not me, and like I say often to you guys, if that's what you want, there are people out there who I think claim that, and they may well have it, and go sit at their feet. But my journey can be hard. And this week, I was touched by something that happened. I think I've talked about this, maybe not on in the class, but just many of you. Blanche's and my accountant said to us a little over a year ago, you can no longer, in retirement, have two homes. Pick one. It's kind of Sophie's Choice is the way my mind went into that. Pick one, because I love my LA home and I love this home. This home is rented, the home in LA is paid for. This home may be one of the most light-filled, beautiful spaces ever, and it has a group of people who I love who come here every week, you guys. But LA has a group of people who come every week, and I love them as well. And I go there once a month to be with them. It's my home of 35 years. This is my home of 3 years. And the landlord just raised the rent a lot. And so the clarity of needing to move is very big. And every so often, Blanche and I look at houses we would like to live in, and they're all, anybody who knows this area, Marin County, you know, entry-level houses are 1.5 million. In many ways. And the houses we like are way out of a price range that we can buy. But it hasn't stopped us from looking. And this week we actually found a place that was quite interesting. And our realtor, whose name is Robin Miller, who's sitting right here, who has been our realtor for 4 years while we've been contemplating possibly getting something here, and who's tried to help us get into all of these different homes that we have come close to getting into. Every time I get close, something happens in me, and I don't know how to describe it, but it is a kind of doors shut down, all clarity evaporates, and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to make a decision about it. Too much is at stake. The future, the pocketbook, goes on and on and on. Very human dimensional stuff. Everything is kind of right, but not right. Good on some level, not good on another. Well, this house we found the other day was really what I call feather balanced close. We were really talking about making an offer. Robin got us into the house. We looked around. It was like this. It wasn't really a classroom, which was problematic, but there was a really big living room and we could build a classroom, and the price was kind of okay. I can go on and on about this house, but all I can tell you is I finally said, I think what happened is they told us, you have to make an offer by tomorrow at noon. We have two cash offers on the table. So we had, at that point, 18 hours to make a decision about what to do. And I don't like those dramas. Usually I try to walk away from them. And finally, I just said, no, we're not going to do it. And I went to bed that night and could not sleep, thinking I'd made a big mistake. I woke up in the morning and said, Blanche, I think I made a big mistake. And I talked to Robin, I don't remember all the logistics of this. But anyway, I looked at the house once again, and I measured with a tape measure to see if anything would fit, or everything would fit really well. The only problem was this house, it's so much about it. End of a cul-de-sac overlooking a wetland with an airport, Marin Airport, at the very back of it, and airplanes landing all the time, which to me was a negative, and bunkers, they called hangars in the background. And I didn't like the view, but it was pretty majestic in some ways, big sky, but little problems. And I didn't know what to do, and I finally said, nope, we're not doing this. And the deadline for the offer passed, and I felt I've made a terrible mistake. I call Robin, can we go one more day? And she says, I'll make the call. They say, yes, you can have it until tomorrow at whatever time. And I, all night long, back and forth, decorating, redecorating the house, trying to think how it would accommodate all you guys, what happens with everybody in Los Angeles if we end up selling the house in Los Angeles, so many dramas. And we end up, I say to my son, Josh, come with me and look at the house. and bring the kids and we'll just look and we'll walk around and we'll see. And they were going to go to a parade, and the parade was, the kids wanted to go to the parade and didn't want to go look at a house, but he agreed and he said he would come there. I am driving to this, look at this house this one last time. And I will tell you, the night before, Blanche and I went and snuck in because we knew the gate code. And we walked around the house and saw the most beautiful sunset. And we're going, oh, this is amazing. But I was still, you know, featherweight. What do you do? And I'm driving there and I could not get an answer. Nothing would come through saying, this is what you do. This is how it should be. Nothing. And I was really annoyed. And I just started talking out loud, thinking, thank God for cell phones, because people don't know you're talking to God. And I'm going, tell me something, anything. Because we had to make the decision. Robin came with her computer, with all the papers that had to be printed out, so we could make the offer within an hour and a half of our looking at the house. We get there. My son Josh arrives with his kids, my grandchildren. And I should say before that, as I in the car, I said, give me an answer, give me clarity, give me something so I know how not to be a clueless human being in a very important decision that was going to affect everything probably for the rest of my life. And I said, I'll be open to anything you say. And then this very quiet voice came in, or note, or awareness, and it said, look at your grandchildren. And that was really interesting. And I watched my grandchildren run through this house and run around the house. And there were all these pockets of really beautiful landscaping that were really inviting and wonderful. They couldn't care less. The house itself did not resonate particularly with them. I said to Talia, my granddaughter, okay, what's your feeling? Thumbs up, thumbs down. She goes like this. And my grandson went, oh, it's okay. I like it, it's okay. No decision. I didn't know what to do. And then Joshua, my son, looks at me and said, Dad, this is not your house. And the minute he said it, I looked at Robin and I felt terrible because she's been working with us for so long and working so hard to help us get something. But when Josh said it, the weight lifted off, the confusion separated, and something in me went, I know, it's not my house. And I said to Robin, I'm really sorry. For the 400th time, I'm really sorry, but we're gonna say no. And I walked away and the day just lightened up. And I felt freed of the manic cluelessness that had taken over because something very quiet, this thumb sideways, and my son Josh going, no. And the freedom of all that. Now, you may all be asking, where's Blanche in all this? She doesn't want to go through this again with me. She has gone through this with me now on 4 homes. And she just said, honey, it's your choice. I want to be where you are happy. I want to be where you are happy. Even though I know she would be happier here than anywhere because she loves this area, but it's so crazy expensive. So we are still in this dance of trying to figure out what to do. We have one more year in this house and we're leaving either back to LA or to another house here, but most likely back to LA. How that's all going to work out, I don't know. But in life, you are not always given everything. In life, you have choices. I do not want to regret any of my choices. And I was in a place where I could have had deep regrets if I had gone one way or the other. And I really felt that inside. And the moment I saw this house through the eyes of my children and grandchildren, I just said, oh, now I see. Cluelessness went away. Decision was made, right or wrong, it was made, and life returned to some kind of stable space. And I felt this thing inside rise up and go, yep. Didn't even say yep about the house. It just said yep. I found my way back to stillness, back to myself, back to acceptance, back to detachment, because clearly I was dealing with attachment. And Blanche asked me, how can you be a teacher and in this Buddhist tradition for so long with so much attachment? And I mean, it's a really good question. And all I could come up with as an answer was, detachment is not necessarily a total, absolute, constant state. It is an earned state, an ability to let go. Rudy taught continually about this word, surrender. Walking around in a state of permanent surrender may be something that some people arrive at. And I think that must be lovely. I've always talked about the Aso character, the man who, no matter what happened to him, he went Aso, Aso, Aso. I think that may be something to search for and to attain. But I have to say, if you're living enmeshed in the world and you have big decisions to make, if you have a Sophie's choice to make and they want one child or another child from you, which is massive, I don't think you go Aso. I don't think it's like that. It's not like that for me. If that's a marker of what makes a great teacher, then clearly I have failed that marker. But the one thing I knew when this was over is I had explored every avenue I could to make this decision. Every avenue I could. I wrote to a friend who's traveling in France, my friend Larry, and said, what would you advise? I wrote to a friend in London who had at one point offered to buy my house in Los Angeles. And I said, are you interested still? I mean, there was no place I didn't go to, but all of those, as I said earlier, were all outside and they could not provide the answer. And they all did give answers. But the real thing that had to come was by knocking on that door, saying, help me in some way. And then the solution was, and it was really quiet. You could easily have missed it. But I listened, and the guidance was simple, and the reaction to making that choice was liberating. The detachment came. I had to earn the detachment. I had to process the attachment. I had to go through this journey. We all have to go through these journeys over and over and over and over. I will never stop preaching this Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane having to decide whether to go through this awful experience that was awaiting him or not, begging to have the cup taken from his lips. We're human, we're in bodies, we have lives, we have all these forces at work. What do we do? What do we do? Well, I'm going to reference back to what I started out with. Most of us are clueless about what to do. Looking outside yourself for clarity will not necessarily be helpful, although it will help you process. The answer still doesn't come from outside. My friend Larry could not have given me my answer. My friend Paul in London couldn't have given me the answer. In a way, all those answers really don't come from outside until the universe tells you your grandchildren or my son. Here's the takeaway, and this is really important. Human beings are very imbalanced in their complete weightedness with the material, outer, manifested world. That is only half of our equation. It's only half. The other half is the inner, or the uprising connectivity to higher power. There are two halves. If you live only in the world, which is not uncommon, the world will cause you grief and suffering because the world is clueless. If you find this deep inner space in you that begins to dialogue with you, to listen to you, to inform you, to instruct, to inspire, and to deliver grace, you will find this balance, this equilibrium, this harmony of being that is worth it, invaluable. But it is not some kind of spiritual bargain where if I'm spiritual, you will be endlessly guided and nothing will happen that will be a problem. It will all be easy and nothing's difficult. No. Life is still what it is. It's just supported with clues. There are clues that they give you, quiet, inner-directed clues that come in the direction of balance. And if you can get quiet enough and you can talk directly to yourself will in some ways, if you're listening, provide you with the clue or the answer that you need. And you will be relieved by that. You will be restored by that. You will be refreshed. You will be reawakened. It's the journey we're on. It's the journey we're all on. And all I can tell you is if you're sitting in front of that doorway with your cup of tea and looking at your cell phone once in a while, you're not going to walk inside. You're not going to be invited into the temple. If you sit there in the rain and the summer sun and you wait and you beg and you hope, at some point they may invite you in. But the really important thing is to knock or try the handle. And if you can, go inside and you will discover, you're here. We've been waiting for you. Sit down, have a cup of tea. It's really right wonderful in here. Get quiet and watch what happens. And you get quiet and the atmosphere starts glowing and you start going, oh, this is, wow. And then it gets beautiful and then the walls fall away and then the temple falls away and the church falls away and the walls of everything that locks you in falls away and you get this vision and this sense of, oh my God, it's so big and it's so beautiful and it cares about me. It's touching me, it's embracing me. I am that. And then walls are back, finish your cup of tea and you walk back out into the world and you walk back out with a sense that the world is in some ways deeply connected to and involved in this deep inner space. And they're all connected and they work together. And if you find the source of that working relationship, you will be so grateful in your worldly journey. It's not easy out there. And when you're clueless, it's terrifying and difficult. And when you live in difficult times, which we're starting to look at in ways that are unusual for us, you need this. You need this. 1960s, 70s America, you know, yeah, you need it. But this is stuff's going on. We all know stuff's going on. You need to knock on the door. You need to try the handle. You need to go inside. You need to do more than sit on the steps with your iPhone and your cup of Starbucks. You need to enter inside and you need to reach for help. And it's waiting for you. It is waiting for you. And if you do it casually on occasion, it won't be there. But if you make yourself known, it will show up and it will help you. It will take you. It will free you. It will give you balance in the harmony and grace in your life. And you will be so happy that you find that this wholeness of being. Nobody escapes life without struggle. Nobody. So get all the help you can get. And it really, it's sitting inside you. There are reinforcements. There are inspirations. There are muses. There are energies that love you as you are, that care about you, that embrace you, and will lift you up when you're falling down. That's all I can tell you. Don't be clueless. The only clue you need in life is go inside and find out the answers that are waiting for you, the clues that you need. Thank you. Any questions? No cluelessness at all. I know it sounds easy on some level, but I don't meet many people who do it. Mostly the people I meet, you can think of this on your own, you don't need to tell me, are casual seekers, casual people sitting on the on the doorsteps. You know, what they call them, winter soldiers. They only go in when they only go to the temple when things are hard. Or summer soldiers who only sit outside the temple when the sun's shining and it's comfortable. You need to be a full weather, full bodied person who really cares. I really think if I have anything in me that has earned the right to talk to you, it's that I have pursued this every day for the last half century, every day, that I do not miss a day. I have not missed a sit for the 44 years until my awakening, and now it's all I do. All I do is this. You can do that. You can have it. The universe supports it. It loves your journey. You're here for a reason. It's big. It's waiting for anyone who will listen and knock and enter. It's waiting. Trust me. It's not like it doesn't care. It's just waiting for anybody who pays attention. You know, and if all you're thinking about is making money or, you know, having fun and getting drunk and going to movies and watching, you know, 20-hour television episodes, okay, it'll give you all that. It will. But, it's here for you if you want it. It will tell you what to do. So I'm gathering there's no questions because I'm still talking. Okay. Thank you, guys. Blanche, are we here next week or the week? Yeah, we're here next week. Okay. One more week here, and then I will be gone for 2 weeks. I'm going to go to New York to teach and then to L.A., and then I'll be back. And Shelley, will you help me figure out the teaching schedule? I don't know. Just keep a line on it because I can't hold on to it, and we'll just keep it circulating. Okay. Thank you all for coming. I deeply, deeply appreciate it.